Welcome back for the presidential address. My name is Heather Dilloway and I'm at Wayne State University. And my job is primarily to introduce who is your past president, I guess, that Nancy Mezzi, so that she can give her presidential address. But I am supposed to announce that they're still counting the votes for the resolutions, and the vote will be announced at the beginning of the awards. So after the presidential address. So I'm very honored, truly honored, to introduce my friend and colleague, Nancy Mezzi. I've known her for 22 years, pretty much almost half my life, not quite, and I've been privileged enough to track my entire academic career against hers. They say it's easiest to stay good friends with people that you have the most in common with, and that's probably true in this case. But at this point, I would say that Nancy's more like a sister to me than a colleague. She is a sister sociologist, and over time, a sister grad student, sister faculty member, sister administrator, pretty much just plain sister. She yells at me as a result. She gives me advice I don't like. She does put up with my snoring over the 20 years we've roomed at conferences together. We've graduated from the grad school the same year, had the same PhD advisor, gotten academic jobs together, have become evil administrators together. There are very few people who I can say that I've really tracked my entire academic career against, although a few others of you are in the room as well. I often sit in meetings at my own institution thinking, what would Nancy do in this meeting? She's my guide as well as a friend and colleague. She's been an anchor for many, including me, and is anchored by a lot of people sitting here. But let me tell you a little bit more about her as a sociologist and why she has made such a good president of SSSP. She's one of the most clear-headed sociologists I know. She stays the course when a lot of us don't. She knows and holds true to our discipline in ways that I'm always boggled by. Especially our ability to maintain our critical analytic edge and our ability to stick to structural and multi-level analyses at all turns. She has a deep loyalty to all things social, as evidenced by the theme of the conference this year, Illuminating the Social. And she has an unwavering ability to see the forest for the trees and keep a broad perspective on what's going on around her, and I think that's commendable. Nancy's sociological imagination guides everything she does. She's a socially conscious consumer. She calls out bad local power when she sees it, which is one of my favorite traits of hers. She organizes and coordinates people for the good of the whole when she can. And she knows that we must be student-centric and faculty-centric in our academic careers as much as possible. But mostly, she knows not to stray from keeping the focus on social justice and fairness and equity. So when a lot of us get lost in the weeds of an individual situation, Nancy doesn't. When the rest of us zone off in meetings and sometimes don't speak our minds, Nancy does. She can remind us of who we are and want to be as sociologists. Nancy's research agenda spans many topics. She applies her sociological lens in new ways all the time. I've been fascinated by that, actually. From lesbian mothers to transgender families to black veterans of world wars to climate change, she carries out an agenda that remains new and challenging, even when she could stay on the same research topic, and that might be easier. Her sociological compass roots her towards strong action, very forthright voice, and better ideas at all turns. I think everyone who knows her well would agree that her ability to state truth in meetings and help us all stay the course is probably one of her best traits, and thus the reason why I'm often asking myself in meetings what Nancy would do in the situation. So I'm only supposed to have 5 minutes to introduce Nancy. I had to cut out a lot of my stories and things that I wanted to say about her, but I can end by saying that SSSP has been in excellent hands this year with Nancy as president. Nancy's made an impact previously on the Board of Governors, on the BFA committee, and in many other leadership positions at SSSP. And many of us, both within SSSP and outside of the SSSP, have learned how to lead and just be as a person from Nancy, and so she's a tough act to follow. As much as I could go on and on here, it's my job to turn it over to you now. And the title of the talk is Start Spreading the News, Illuminating the Effects of Climate Change as a Social Problem. So please give Nancy Mezzia a warm welcome and pay your closest attention, because as I've learned over many years, if not decades, she has lots of advice to give and can be our compass for years to come.
So I have to thank a few people before we get started, in addition to Heather, Kunte Park and the Local Arrangements Committee, Brooke Kelly and the Program Committee, Johanna Foster for the wonderful artwork that you see on the bags and on the program, the Board of Directors and Committee Chairs and members who have all stepped up and made this society move forward, the editors of our fabulous journal, Social Problems, my undergraduate and my graduate alma maters, Vassar College and Michigan State University, for sponsoring my presidency and this society. A special shout out to my home institution, Monmouth University, particularly the provost's office for supporting me, the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, the School of Sciences, and the honor school, just really fabulous colleagues who have pushed me forward and supported me. I'm a New Yorker. I identify as a New Yorker, and there's a bit of a Mezzi clan here, so I want to thank my parents, my siblings, their spouses, my nieces and nephews, my children, my in-laws who have traveled from afar, and my partner who's somewhere over there, who is my rock. She knows that. And I also want to thank Hector, who is unfortunately not in the room right now because he's counting ballots. But Hector is an incredible role model and an incredible mentor to many of us and to me as well. And then I want to thank Michelle Coons, who also is counting ballots at this point. Michelle, you know, all the people that make this organization run do an incredible job, but somebody has to organize that, and someone has to keep track, and someone has to push us forward, and that person is Michelle. She is one of the most incredibly efficient, effective, and good-hearted people that I know. So thank you, Michelle. I'm going to get to my talk in just a second, I really am. As part of the SSSP tradition, we honor the first peoples of our city who had nurtured this land for generations. New York City sits on the land, the traditional lands of the Lenape, the Rockaway, the Canarsie, and the Matinecock people. African slaves arrived in New York City in what is now New York City in the 1620s and played a critical role in building the city. It's important for us to remember, as a social justice organization, these earliest residents whose labor was instrumental to the formation, development, and prosperity of New York. So I just want to say that. Right. So the late Alan Johnson, in his book, The Forest and the Trees, said that he wants to tell us one main thing. If he tells one main thing, that thing would be we are always participating in something larger than ourselves, and that something is systems. And he used this metaphor of the forest and the trees to show that a forest is not just a bunch of individual trees. What makes this bunch of individual trees a forest is the relationships between them. And he uses that as a metaphor for society, because he says society is not just a collection of unrelated individuals, but rather a collection of people who live in particular relationships to each other. And those relationships create the very essence of what we know as being social. So in other words, in order to understand the social world, we need to understand the relationships that exist between and among people that form pattern, structural, institutionalized, calcified relationships that affect our behavior and connect us together. So he says, if you want to understand what's social about social problems, and this just seems really obvious, but if you want to understand what's social about social problems, you have to understand what's structural, that you have to understand what social means.
So the theme for 2019, this theme, is really a call to our membership and our call to our sociologists and social scientists out there to draw deeply and widely on our sociological roots to illuminate the social in all social problems with an eye to solving those social problems and to speak as broadly and widely as we possibly can so that our voices and our discipline are heard. So I'm calling on you through this presidential address to focus on what is perhaps, what I consider to be perhaps the largest, the biggest social problem, which is climate change. Indeed, because we have been missing the proverbial forest for the trees, and we've been focusing on individual rather than social solutions, we are facing grave danger. So I'm a feminist family sociologist. I'm not a climate scientist, and I'm not even an environmental sociologist. And I picked this topic because after talking to some people, some friends, some colleagues, my partner who's an environmental consultant, I was saying, look, what can I say to a group of sociologists that might actually push this field forward, that might mean something? And it just kept coming back to climate change. So I chose this topic really not because it's my area of expertise, but I chose this topic because I think it really is something that we as sociologists need to consider strongly. So the problem with studying climate change is that it's incredibly vast. Bugs to big business. I mean, you can talk, we could do this entire talk on how bugs, climate change affecting bugs that affects us, right? But I've decided to narrow this down, and I'm talking specifically about rising sea levels in New York City, and I'm going to question where sociologists are in that topic, right? Where are we in that discussion? One of the things that's fascinating to me when as I was doing the research for this study is to try to figure out the science, because I knew that the climate change was happening, but I honestly didn't really understand what the science was behind it. So I'm just going to do a really brief science lesson here, and I apologize for those people who already know this, but I just have to sometimes assume that if I didn't know something, somebody else might not have known it either. So this is how it works. The sun sends down energy in the form of light. It hits the Earth. The light, most of the light, gets reflected off as infrared radiation. And some of it is absorbed to keep the Earth warm, but most of it is sent off to cool the Earth down. And the main force that reflects that light off are ice caps. So ice reflects the light. What's happening, though, is that we have an increase in greenhouse gases, and those greenhouse gases absorb the heat. Some of the heat's good because we want to keep ourselves, we have to be able to sustain life on Earth. But if you have too much, it starts heating the Earth up. And when the Earth starts heating up, it melts the ice. And the problem with melted ice is it becomes water. And unlike ice, water absorbs heat. So when it's humid out, the moisture in the air, even though it's 80 degrees, it might feel like 90 degrees because the moisture is holding in the heat. And what we know is that this absorption of water is a self-perpetuating, accelerated system. It's a self-recycled system. And so it makes it really, really hard for scientists, climate scientists, NASA, to predict the acceleration rate at which we are heating up. And we know that it's just getting worse, right? I mean, this is from a week ago where we see the highest level rate of heat in Europe that are melting the ice. Okay. The other thing that's really important to know before we start is that the increase in greenhouse gases, so nitrous oxide, carbon dioxide, and methane, is that the increase is correlates to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, so about 150 years. That's when we see that increase. And we see that increase then with a rising sea level correlating at the same time as well. So that's the science behind this. And I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but that's what I got. But what's important for us as sociologists is to understand the anthropogenic driving forces of climate change. And by anthropogenic, what I'm really talking about are the political, social, cultural, economic causes of climate change. And so I want to go through six of these to just sort of lay this out. The number one driving force of anthropogenic generated greenhouse gases is economic growth. So we have created an economic system that pits profit over environment, And what that means is that the very economics and political and social systems that we have created are causing the degradation of our climate, are increasing greenhouse gases and causing the degradation. So how does that work? So that's the macro level, right? So global capitalism. How does that work? So we know we went from an agrarian to an industrial to a post-industrial society. We are now in a consumer economy. We're an economy where we produce and consume as much as we possibly can. And we do that because we want to profit. We want, the businesses want to profit, and we are told that this is the right thing to do. So we produce a lot of goods, by doing so, we have to use a lot of energy to do that. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And we also consume as much as we possibly can. So we're consuming food, and we're consuming cars, and electronics, and clothing, so flash fashions that we consume on a regular basis. And the problem with this is that it causes waste. Right, so it needs a lot of energy, and before we get that, so we've made it really, really easy, right, we've made it really, really easy to consume as much as we possibly can. So in the 10 minutes that I've been talking right now, you all probably could have bought a house or purchased most of the stuff for that house just sitting here right from your seat. We've made it really easy to consume quickly and as much as possible. And the problem, again, is that it causes waste. Now, waste for animals is the environment is a problem, but in terms of greenhouse gases, what's particularly important is food waste. So when we take food waste and we put it in a landfill, it creates anaerobic conditions, right? So we're in anaerobic conditions, and the gas that's released from that is methane, and methane is 85 times more potent as a greenhouse gas as is carbon dioxide. If we put that same food into a compost pile, it produces carbon dioxide, not methane. But an anaerobic landfill, so all the food that we are wasting, and you've seen it just in the last couple days, you see it all the time, right, that's creating a huge amount of methane gas, which is a huge greenhouse gas. Okay, so in addition to economic growth and production and consumption and waste, we have energy use. So we use all sorts of types of non-renewable energies that, for the most part, have a pretty big carbon footprint. So particularly petroleum products and electricity, which comes out of coal, it's slightly cleaner than petroleum products and gas products. We know that we do have, right, we have the technology to use renewable clean energy, but that's not necessarily what we generally use. We're not using that very much. In addition, the other anthropogenic driving force is land use and natural resources. So environmental sociologists have been studying this for years. We've been cutting down Amazon forests for years. And here's the problem with this, other than for all the bees and the bugs and the animals and just sheer beauty, right? The problem is that trees are the lungs of the earth, right? These forests are the lungs of the earth. Trees are the only thing on earth that breathes in greenhouse gas and breathes out oxygen. So we have essentially, we're cutting down the lungs of the earth. In addition, we know, by the way, that this is not getting any better. And again, these are New York Times and Washington Post articles from just a couple days ago, a week ago. In addition, we're building roads, and those roads are there to take us from urban area to urban area, drive around suburbs, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second. But it's an opportunity to drive cars and use energy and fuel and to mass produce and bring those goods around the country, right, and around the world. And the other thing is that asphalt is black, and black absorbs the heat, so it's another cause of the global heating. Land use also involves the use of farms, and we know that the United States, in particular, subsidizes the growth of corn, and we use corn particularly to produce food for animals, not produce food for people. And here's the thing about animals, is that they too produce greenhouse gases in the form of manure, and they don't just it's not carbon dioxide that they produce in manure, it's nitrous oxide, which is 300 times the potency of carbon dioxide. And this is the last anthropogenic driving force of climate change that I'm going to talk about, which is urbanization and suburbanization. It's really hard to talk about these separately because when you have an urban area, generally you have a huge suburban area around that. I'm going to talk about that when I talk specifically about New York City. So this is from the United Nations, and what they say is, what this map shows is the red areas are the areas where, in those countries, the majority of people live in urban areas. right? So in those countries, the majority of people live in urban areas in the red countries. And what we know about urban areas is that they are a sinkhole for global wealth. So if you look around any city, but if, and we'll look at New York in a second, but if you look at any city, they're a sinkhole for people with global wealth to put their money, particularly into real estate. And so in New York City alone, 24% of New York City's apartments are luxury homes for the global 1%. We also know that 2% of New York City's 1 million buildings uses 45% of New York City's energy. And this is a big point because a lot of environmental sociologists and people who are studying climate change are saying that it's not just any part of the city that's parts of cities can be very green, but it's because of global wealth being put into large luxury homes that is really causing the largest set part of greenhouse gases. So that's these two are New York City stats. The rest are just general stats, right? Cities generate 60 to 70% of all anthropogenic greenhouse gases. 35 to 45% is through heating and cooling. 35 to 40% is through transportation. The suburbs, and again, this is, depends on the unit analysis, but the suburbs account for 50% of all household emissions. Okay. So we know that climate change is happening, and we know that people are causing it. We also know that climate change is a social justice issue. And again, this is an area that environmental sociologists have been studying for a long time. And it's a social justice issue for many reasons, but I'm going to just talk about two. So it's a social justice issue. Climate change is a social justice issue because there's an unequal production of greenhouse gases. So if you look at the highest income group around the world, so this is by income, not by region. I'll show you region in a second. So 16% of the population lives in a high income category, and they produce 38% of all greenhouse gas. If you add the upper middle income here, you get 51% of the population producing 86% of all carbon dioxide. And if you look at the 49% of lower middle and low income people, they're producing 14%. If you go down right here to the lowest income, it's 9% of the population producing less than 1% of all greenhouse gases. If you look by region, what you find is that in North America, so this is per capita carbon emissions per year, right? So North America is 5% of the population, and they're producing 18% of emissions. Europe is 10% of the population, producing 16% of emissions. And if you jump over to Asia, it's 60% of the population, producing 49% of emissions. And then you've got Africa, which is 16% of the population, producing 4% of emissions. So it's unequal production of greenhouse gases, and it has an unequal impact. So when you look at, and we as sociologists and social scientists know that there's a lot of reasons why there are global inequalities, and that's well beyond the discussion of this talk, but we know that, and again, this is an area that environmental sociologists have been talking about, right? We know that disadvantaged groups tend to have a greater exposure to climate hazards. They have a greater susceptibility, really hard for me to say that word, to damages caused by climate hazards. And people that are in disadvantaged areas have less ability to cope with those problems. And all of this does is create a cycle of greater inequality. So if you're questioning what this might look like, think about Katrina in New Orleans. Think about Matthew in Haiti. Think about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, right? And there's other examples. So thinking about what countries are producing all the greenhouse gases, I know that this map is not easy to read, so I got that. But what's really important here is the colors, right? So the lighter the color is, the least vulnerable the area is to climate hazards. So the better they are able to adapt. It's not that hurricanes don't hit there, and it's not that sea levels aren't rising. It's just that when they do, those countries are able to adapt and get back on their feet quickly. The darker an area is, the more vulnerable they are to climate hazards, the less likely they are to be able to recover. So you see that, particularly for Africa, produces the least amount of greenhouse gas and is at grave danger in terms of most vulnerability. You can see that the United States and Europe produce the most amounts of greenhouse gas, and they are least vulnerable. And the only area that really comes out even on this one is Asia, which produces almost half greenhouse gases, and they're suffering. So, climate change is happening, human beings are causing it, and it's creating inequalities and exacerbating inequalities around the world. Okay, So, what's happening in New York City, this great city that we are in? So, New York City is really made up of a tri-state area. And when we talk about the tri-state area, we talk about New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And what we know about New York City, right, in terms of numbers, is that we've got 520 miles of city waterfront. We've got about almost 9 million people in New York City alone, right, that's made up of the five boroughs of New York City. And we have almost 24 million people who live in the tri-state area. For those of you who flew in, you know that we have three major airports, we've got all sorts of shipping industry, we've got mass transportation in terms of buses, in terms of, and some of you might have taken a tour of Grand Central Station, of trains, of subways, of tunnels in terms of private transportation in, we've got bridges, we've got refineries and water treatment plants, we've got all sorts of telecommunications, and we have the New York Stock Exchange. So if you're wondering where global capitalism, the bastion of global capitalism is, you are sitting in it right now. So let's talk about rising sea levels in New York City and what that means. So these are data from newyorkcity.gov, and I'll talk about that a little bit in a couple minutes. New York City says that 66% of all greenhouse gas emissions are coming from their buildings. Now, you have to remember, 1% of all the buildings in New York City produces 45% of all greenhouse gases. So this is not all buildings in New York City. These are the big luxury Trumplandia buildings that are here, right? 4% of those greenhouse gas emissions are coming out of waste, and another 30% is coming out of transportation. And this chart, it has a bunch of information about average temperature and precipitation, but I want to talk about sea level rise. And remember, so we talked about ice melting, right? And that it's accelerating, the sea levels are rising at accelerated light rates. And climate scientists don't necessarily, it's really hard for them to predict the rate at which they're increasing, which means that we're going to have these wide predictions. So these predictions are from, in 2050, anywhere from a sea level rise, and I'm going to just focus on sea level rise because that's what I've decided to focus on, is 11% to 30% by 2050, and those sea levels are going to rise anywhere between 22 and 75 inches by 2100. And that's when the predictions end. It's not when the sea level stops rising. It's just when the prediction ends. So to put this another way, if you look at 50 years ago, right, in 1950, if you look at the sea level rise and the bulkhead, at high tide, the sea level was just below that bulkhead. But now, since sea level has risen about 6.5 inches, it's at high tide, we see flooding. So in other words, in the last 48 years, we've seen 6 inches of sea level rise. And in the next 14 years, we're going to see the same amount. So it's accelerating. So what does this mean for New York City? It means that the floodplain is expanding. And if you look at the blue, that's the blue here is by 2020, which we are essentially in 2020, just about, right? So this is not like the far future. And the white, which is a little harder to see on this, is 2080. And what the floodplain means is that as the sea levels rise, some of this is going to be underwater a lot of the time. Some of it's going to be underwater as nuisance flooding, and we're seeing this already. So if you think that it hasn't happened, just think 7 years ago to Hurricane Sandy. Superstorm Sandy. It's not a hurricane, right? I'll talk about that in a second. So these are pictures. That's the New York subway. These are Staten Island. This is a picture I actually took in my hometown down on the Jersey Shore. It says, go away, Sandy. And this is also on the Jersey Shore in Mantalocke. So this is the ocean, and that's the bay, and that's where the two decided to meet on October 29, 2012. This, by the way, I just have to say, this is in 35. And my partner and I ride our bike along this quite a bit, actually. This is our favorite route right here to ride our bike down. Not in October of 2012. So what caused Superstorm Sandy? And it was a superstorm, it was a Category 1. It wasn't anything more than that, a Category 1. It was hurricane-like conditions with a very strange jet stream where the hot and cold air were meeting and a lunar high tide. And these two factors here, climate scientists are suggesting that those were caused by increased climate change. And what was the impact? So we know that between 140 and 160 people died in Superstorm Sandy. 30% of them were in New York City, mostly in Staten Island, Queens, and Brooklyn. 30% in New Jersey, and 30% in Long Island, which is the eastern suburb, and Connecticut, Westchester, which are the northern suburbs of New York. And those people who died in the floodplain died largely because they drowned. Those people who are outside of the floodplain died because of downed trees, because of downed wires, and because they ran generators in unventilated or poorly ventilated areas.
Over 50% of the people who died were over the age of 65,
but there were some children who died as well, and these are the Moore brothers in Staten Island. Their mother was trying to get away. She tried to get in her car. She realized she couldn't go. She got out, and the two kids were swept away on her street.
In addition to that damage that was done, 21.3 million people were without power on the day that Sandy hit. 3.7 million people were out of power at least a week later. Between $80 and $100 billion were done in direct damage, and about $10 to $16 billion was done in indirect damage from business interruption. And there's a quote that I'd like to read from Ashley Dawson's book, Extreme Cities. Ashley Dawson's an English professor at CUNY Graduate Center. And he wrote, "Hurricane Sandy accomplished what the Occupy Wall Street protests had been unable to do the previous autumn. It shut down the world's preeminent financial hub, the New York Stock Exchange." And my partner and I sometimes joke, not so funny, but that Mother Nature will always win, and she seems to be winning now. So what's New York City doing? And there's a lot to be said about what people are doing. New York City, under Mayor Bloomberg and now under de Blasio, has a city one plan. And their idea is really to try to create some climate justice. They're trying to reduce greenhouse gases. They say they want to reduce greenhouse gases completely by 2050, and that they've already reduced that greenhouse gas by 17% in 2017. This, by the way, is a great area for some of our members to start thinking about assessing and figuring out whether what they're saying is really true. How are they doing this? They've increased solar power, particularly on the top of those buildings. They've given incentives to upgrade dirty trucks. They have the largest municipal electrical fleet in the country. They've built 244 miles of bike lanes. They have a plant 1 million tree program. And they want to build reinforcement around the financial district. And I understand, right? I understand that there are some people who live there. But remember, the vast majority of people who got flooded out in Sandy lived in Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. And they're protecting the financial district. So again, I want to see global capitalism at work. But the idea that New York City has is to create what's called a circular economy, so that there's no additional energy in and no additional waste out. So they want to manufacture, they package, they use, we use. We finish with that and we throw it out. We collect, the city collects the garbage, they recycle it, and then they reuse it. So it's a circular economy. And again, it's a great area for people to determine whether, you know, policy, sociologists, a policy to determine whether or not this is really working. I don't want to just, I want to acknowledge that there are lots of grassroots organizations as well that are working on the ground in terms of trying to create environmental justice. This is an organization called New York Renews. It's a coalition of 150 non-governmental, local, state, and city government groups that have come together to try to address this issue. Okay. We know that climate change is real, we know that human beings are causing it, we know that it's creating incredible inequality around the world, and we know that we can use New York City as a really good example of not only a city that is a global sinkhole, but that also is trying to come up with some interesting and innovative ideas of how to make their city greener. So this is a question I set out really to answer was, where are sociologists in this conversation? So we know that there is an entire group of sociologists who have been dedicated for the last several decades to study environmental relationships to human beings and environmental sociology. And so we have our own division of the Social of Environment and Technology, who have put together several panels at this meeting. And we have our Social Problems Journal that also has published some really, really seminal pieces in climate change and inequality.
economic inequalities. The American Sociological Association also has a division of environmental sociology. And there's a fair amount of journals that environmental sociologists are publishing in. So I don't want to dismiss or ignore the good work that our environmental sociologists have been doing. In fact, I had at 7:15 this morning was with a group of welcoming new members and sat with two graduate students who are studying environmental sociology. So the discipline, the field is alive and well. The problem is that sociology has, as a field, as a discipline, hasn't really embraced environmental sociology as a lens through which we look, right? So it's a marginalized, in our own discipline, it's a marginalized area of study. And the other problem is that it's not a loud voice. So environmental sociology is not a loud voice within sociology. It's also not a loud voice outside in the world. And the theme that I've picked for this, if you remember, is illuminating the social and social problem. And part of that call is for all of us to have our voice be heard widely. So who's being heard widely on the discussion of climate change? Largely scientists, natural scientists. And what natural scientists are really good at are naming the problem and talking about the problem and finding technology to solve the problem, but it's not their venue, it's not their area to talk about the social relationships that cause these problems in the first place. That's our job, that's what we do. What are the structural and cultural factors that perpetuate these systems and continue to have them go? The technology is there, by the way. I mean, the scientists have created the technology, we know what's happening. The social piece is not there yet. In addition, there are some journalists, right? So pick up any venue, New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, like any day you'll see any number of articles written about climate change. There are a few folks in the humanities, so that's Extreme Cities by the professor of English at CUNY. And then there are other social scientists, there are economists who are talking pretty loudly about climate change. Economists, and again, it's a sister discipline, and I don't mean any disrespect, but oftentimes they're using theories like rational choice, which really exists at the individual level and not the structural level. So it's all important work, but the question is, where are the sociologists? And how do we get involved in this discussion if we really want to illuminate climate change as a social problem? How can we intervene? So the main way that sociologists can contribute to the understanding of and the solutions to climate change is to study climate change as a social problem. And this is to stimulate the discussion of doing that. Right, so one of the things that I think that we do best, and Heather raises, is we talk about social structure, right? We talk about the calcified relationships that bring us together, that create our social institutions, that create our social inequalities, that create these categories. That's our business, that's what we talk about, is social structure. And we also talk about how that integrates with culture, because you cannot have a structure, no structure will exist and last if we don't have a culture that says it's a good thing. Right? If we didn't think that it was really good and fun and great to buy, then global capitalism, if we didn't believe that profit over environment was important, then global capitalism couldn't exist. It just wouldn't exist. And by the way, I'm guilty of this too. I have my Amazon Prime account, so I'm not trying to call anybody out. I'm guilty of this as well. Because culture's hard to change, right? But that's something that we study, and it's something that's important for us to look at. And then agency, right? So some of you know that I handed out metal straws, and that was not to indicate that each of us should just continue to use metal straws. It's a symbol, it's supposed to be a symbol that we all have agency, right? Can you get one? Well, I'll get you one. It's a symbol that we all have the agency to make some change. You can also use it, carry it in your bag, so instead of using straws, you can use that. But agency is not just on the individual level, it's also on the local level, right? So how do we convince our local towns to stop using single-use bags, right? To get rid of all single-use bags in all of our stores. How do we do that? How do we use collective agency to change systems? And that's one of the other things that sociologists do really, really well. We study social movements. So we have strong roots. We have strong theoretical roots that can really lead this discussion. But we also have empirical tools that can help lead this discussion as well. So I'm a family feminist family sociologist, and I study social institutions. And one of the great things about studying social institutions is that it's that sort of mid-level, right? It's a structural level, but it also talks about how people work on the ground. I really wanted to do this talk on how climate changes affect families and how families affect climate change. I wasn't able to because the data aren't there. Nobody has done the studies, or very few people. UC Berkeley is doing some studies on the household level, but not on the family level. And that's a whole other discussion about the difference, but we can talk about that if you want. So it's great research if you can build on it. But I actually, unless I had built an entire body of empirical data to do that talk on, which I didn't, then I couldn't do that talk. The other great thing about those of us who study social institutions is that we study social institutions as they intersect. So wouldn't it be really great to know how families and education and policy and politics and sport and religion, all of those institutions interact in our lives in certain ways to shape climate change and to be shaped with climate change. And that big macro version, that big macro view of all of those connections, those forests for the trees, is really what we do. The other thing is climate justice, and this is an area I would say that we are actually working on in terms of climate justice. It's something that environmental sociologists have been working on. But one of the suggestions I would have, and there's a book that the American Sociological Association put out called Climate Change in Society. They published it in 2015, and a lot of these recommendations will come from there. But one of the things that I would recommend for climate justice is facilitate the participation of underrepresented voices in climate change politics. All the research suggests, and this is not shocking, all the research suggests that for any of these solutions to work, we have to make sure that underrepresented voices are heard. And this is an area for climate justice to expand on. We could talk about adaptation. It's not my favorite subject, and the reason that it isn't is because adaptation seems like a defeatist kind of attitude. Like, we can't change it, so let's just figure out how we're going to adapt. But it is really important to figure out how we adapt. And in terms of adaptation, I think we need to develop methods to ensure that all affected populations, including disadvantaged groups, are included and their needs are included in the discussions of how do we adapt so that that cycle of inequality doesn't increase because of global climate change. Social movements are something that sociologists study really well. And I think one of the areas here is that we could study the ideas and strategies of grassroots social movements and non-governmental organizations that are advocating, right? So what are these grassroots doing and how are they advocating and how are they talking about social structure and how are they talking about agency and culture all together? Public opinion, I think, is one of the really important areas. So scientists have told us what the problem is and they've told us what solutions we can take, and we're not doing it. Right? So why is that? What is public opinion around climate change, and why are we not taking up some of those solutions? And what's happening with climate skeptics and climate deniers? Why do we have those when the evidence is really, really clear? And last, I think all of the information that we develop as sociologists, and this is where I think we can, and social justice researchers, many of us, we can inform policy, and that would be really, really important. Okay. So how do we illuminate climate change as a social problem? We draw deeply on our structure and culture and agency's theoretical roots. We draw deeply on our empirical tools and take all those tools out of our knapsack and put them to good use. So here's something. I started studying sociology at Vassar College in 1983. And Social Problems in 1986 published an article by Judith Stacey and Barry Thorne called, I don't get the title right, The Missing Feminist Revolution in Sociology. And so at that time, when I started studying sociology, feminist theory was on the side. It was a marginalized area. And it took a lot of people pushing that study forward and to use feminist language to shift the theoretical center and the empirical center. And we have done that. In fact, I don't know very many sociologists worth their salt who do not take some sort of feminist or intersectional analysis in their research. We have shifted the center as a discipline. And so what I think we need to do, if we want to really recognize and illuminate climate change as a social problem, what we really need to do is take that lens, whatever theoretical lens we're using, and overlay it on top of it, a climate change lens, so that anything that we study, we don't have to be environmental sociologists. We have to be whatever sociologists we are to think about how does climate change affect any of the areas that we're studying. I mean, think about migration, for example, and there's some articles coming out now a lot more about migration patterns. I mean, if your island is sinking or your crops are burning, you're going to move, right? And so a lot of the reasons that we're seeing a lot of migration is because of climate change. So anything that we study, we should really be illuminating climate change as a social problem. And the other thing is that, and by the way, so we have half of our membership who are graduate students. So I just want to say I just gave you all your doctoral, your dissertation topics right here. because this field is wide open. But the other thing is that many of us are in the classroom. And so if you don't want to change your empirical lens and you don't want to change the work that you're doing, then I would encourage you to bring this into your classroom. And it doesn't have to be just the sociology of climate change, although that would be really cool. And the associate dean in the School of Science and I are talking about doing a paired clustered class where she does the science and I do the social science of it. It'd be pretty cool. But we can bring this into all of our classes. Any of us, you can have it, bring it into family sociology, you can bring it into any of the fields that you study. And so what I ask in terms of giving this presidential address is that we consider and we try and work together to illuminate climate change as a social problem. And I'm happy to share with you any of my resources that you that I've used. And I will stop and take questions. Thanks. So questions from the floor. Yes. There's actually a microphone here if you want to come to it.
Oh, sure.
All right. Or someone could pass it around.
I was in a volunteer group. A division of the Sierra Club called Ready for 100, right? And I got really dispassionate about it because the first time that we sent out resolution to the mayor, it was like for 2035, and then it just kept getting higher. There won't be a world to live in 2050, perhaps. So, you know, how do we address that? Like, how can you make it something that's reasonable for people in policy who don't really want to do, like, they want to put it off, but something that they can still engage with because this is a problem.
Right. So I think part of the problem, it's a great question, and thank you for that. I think part of the problem is that some of the people that we're engaging with have a vested interest in keeping current systems in place, right? I mean, when we talk about who's, and C. Wright Mills wrote about this, the power elite, right, the connection between government, big business, and military. So they have a vested interest in keeping things going because if we start changing a global capitalist world, they start losing money. And they don't want to do that. So how do you engage in that? I mean, this is an area where people in social movements have struggled. I think you engage at a local level, right? And you try to get as much support, and you talk, rather than the bottom line, you start talking about voting patterns. And if you can convince people that they won't get elected because they're climate deniers and they're not moving forward, then that might have some use. There are people in this room, I'm sure, that are really experts in community organizing. I know they are because I know who they are. There's some really experts in this area, and this would be a really interesting conversation about how do we bring into us as public sociologists, right? How do we take what we're doing and move us into public public sociologists? And I'm really excited about the theme for next year because in that talk about hope, I think we do have to talk about how we voice our opinions much more loudly. I'm not trying to pass the buck on that, but I do think that there's a carryover here. But we should be. I mean, that's part of the call, is to illuminate social problems widely and carefully. So I don't know if I answered that question, but I think that there's lots of discussion that can be generated from that.
Thank you.
Yep. Other questions?
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
My nephew just graduated last year, and so he graduated as an engineer, and he's really excited about waste and climate change. And climate change is his passion, and he is really knowledgeable about how we as a society have individualized waste management in terms of we recycle.
Right.
And he is like educating me so much about how I'm so not contributing by my activities of recycling. So he explains to me that, you know, these are things we should know, that when we recycle, we have to take off the tops, okay? But we also have to take off the rings, and there's all sorts of ways in which we have been made to feel good about these individual activities about recycling, as if we're like contributing to preventing further problems with climate change.
Right.
And so I would like you to sort of address this issue the way that we kind of individualize these activities. At the same time, we are contributing to the problems because the way in which we constructed the solutions are not really the solution, because everything we do has ended up in the middle of the Pacific somewhere and being like wasted instead of like far from our view. So I would like you to talk a little bit about, even though we think we understand the structural problems, we have these individual solutions that actually contribute to the problems, which we don't even see because we're like shipping them off to China that doesn't learn anymore. So anyway, what do we do about the neoliberal solution that is offered to us, and how do we fight against and educate each other about the sort of the much more complex ways in which we're sort of complicit in this, not just simply by buying things and throwing them away and the sort of planned obsolescence, but in the very activity that we think we're doing to solve it.
Right, and the issue of recycling, thank you, Nancy, I appreciate that. The issue of, so we're always taught that individual solutions are, how do we make ourselves feel good, right? So, I can tell you the ways that I make myself feel good. I got a compost pile in the back, I put solar on my roof, and I'm a vegan, right? So that's how I make myself feel good, and I feel like I'm contributing. I also have an Amazon Prime thing, and I have four cars as well. So, four drivers, four cars, what else do you need, right? And so, we make ourselves feel good with these ways that we do it, and I totally agree with that. So, and my partner and I walk into the store all the time and say, leave it and say, why are people using, we live on the Jersey Shore, see people all the time, why are they using these plastic bags? Why aren't they? And we have done honestly nothing about it except for bring our own little bags with us. So we haven't petitioned our council to change that. We haven't even talked to our friends about joining together and ever stepping into the council, the city council, and saying, the town next door has done it. But we have not done that. And why have we not done it? I honestly don't, because we feel good that we have solar on our house. So so I think part of it is education, right? So learning that these issues exist, and then figuring out how we connect with collective action. And we all know, I think, as sociologists, that sometimes it's easier to change structures, so we can change laws, but changing the hearts and minds of people is really, really hard. The other thing about recycling in itself is that's also an issue, because we do ship off everything to China, and China doesn't want it because most of it's dirty, and they don't want to clean it for us. So most of the stuff that we do recycle probably does get thrown out. So I think in terms, I think your question begs the same question that we always ask is, how do we ever create collective action? Is that we create collective action, right? We start building the hearts and minds, we start educating, we start at the grassroots, we run for local election, we run for, we talk to our universities about what they're doing, and we work on those levels. I mean, if you said today, can we have a magic wand and get rid of global capitalism, and that's obviously, I know who I'm talking to, right? So that's obviously not happening. So so I think we start at the local level, but I think we also start at the educating level, and I think, the classroom is a great place, the research is a great place, but we also have to start really engaging in collective action.
Thanks so much for that great talk, Nancy. And I had a quick question about why you think environmental sociology has been marginalized in our history.
Yeah, so what I have read about this, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but what I've read is that for a long time, sociologists have believed that really the forest is made up of human beings, and that the rest of the land is sort of this passive landscape on which we do things, and so hasn't really engaged in how. So we can talk about how the economic systems that we've created affect human beings. We've largely ignored any other being, right? So particularly animals, and that's obviously a burgeoning area in sociology, is the sociology of animals. And so we've just seen really a passive landscape, that environment is a passive landscape, and we're not really sure why people have bothered engaging in that. That's what I've read. And I imagine there's some environmental sociologists who could speak to that as well.
So this is a comment and a suggestion that might reduce some greenhouse gases. So the comment is, what a great presentation. I've never seen the science and the how do I understand climate change in one slide and a quick thing that I can understand. So I thought,
I'm glad I wasn't the only person who didn't understand that problem.
I wish I didn't have to reproduce that. I wonder if this session is being taped in some way and I can show my students it, and then I hope it is. And then I thought, why doesn't SSSP take things like our presidential address so that some people who don't fly across the country can see the great presentations that its presidents give? So a comment, suggestion, and I would love to get access to what we present.
So first of all, I'm happy to share these slides. In fact, for those of you who have downloaded the app, you should have gotten a thing that said, there's a connection to this, and I apologize, I was going to announce that earlier. So SSSP's mobile app, a link to this was available, and I'm happy to keep that live if you want. Social Problems publishes all of the presidential addresses, so you can find them there, but they won't be with photographs, it will be the word, and that is being taped right here. I did think about asking my son to videotape, because he does videotape, or my daughter to videotape, because both of them actually did. But then I thought the pressure of that would be way too high for me, not for them, but for me. So I decided not to. I didn't want to see myself. And there was some discussion about that, putting these online. I'm happy to share that suggestion with the board. You've got some board members, and you've got the next president, the current president, sitting right here. But I think that that's an interesting suggestion. I'm happy to share this. So the other problem with sharing our slides is that we are going to be published, and we all know the problem of publishing is that anything, something's out on the web, then all of a sudden you've published and no one wants to publish it anymore. So I'm comfortable publishing this because this is not what's going to be written in Social Problems. I can't sort of put up pictures. So I'm comfortable, I'm happy to share this. I will say that, you know, there are some copyright issues, you know, if we start sharing this too widely. So some of them are free, and some of them you'd have to get copyright if you really want to start sharing them publicly.
I just have a question about the structural issues you were talking about. So in regards to the mayor's plan for 2050 of being a carbon zero city, I was wondering if structurally he had looked up a plan based on another place. In the world, the only carbon zero places I know of is Bhutan. And speaking of social structural problems, I was wondering if he had looked into that and how that structural
So my answer to that is I don't know, but I certainly could find that out. I think that's a great question. What do we learn from other cities? What do we learn from other countries? What do we learn from each other about how to create better plans? I know that there is, and this by the way is public access. You can get on the New York City one. I'm pointing at it, but it's not there. You can get on the public access to that, and you can read the entire report. I do think that there have been people who have been critiquing the plan and are questioning, you know, is it as inclusive as it should be? Does it really is it really going to be the sort of climate justice kind of project that they want? And I don't have the answer, which is why I encouraged somebody from the membership to start assessing it. Yeah.
So I have a bit of a comment or perhaps more of a suggestion.
Yeah, please.
Because you mentioned migration, and I guess I'm a bit of an outsider here, so I hope I don't offend anybody, but I'm thinking that it's a very US-centric approach that the SSSP has, and I'm wondering if maybe the problem isn't just here, but there are a lot of things in the Global South that we could be looking at that are actually the source of many of the, or the impact of many of the things that we're doing here, and I think that maybe highlighting the real social problems that are actually happening to more disparate communities based on perhaps more privileged positions that we have could perhaps do more of what we're after.
And I think that's a reasonable critique. I yesterday ran a panel, was that just yesterday? Yeah, it might have been. Was a panel with all the presidents of the national organizations, and we invited the president of ISA, the International Sociological Association. I don't know if Dr. Hanafi is in the room, but one of the questions, what do you see as the biggest problem, the biggest social problem? And he said immigration and migration and refugee problems. And he talked largely about the Global South. So the work is being done, and I think that the critique of saying, is SSSP taking a sort of a ethnocentric sort of view, I think is a reasonable critique. And I think partnering with some of these other organizations and listening to what other people are saying will probably help us. So my understanding, and I apologize, I'm thrilled that there's so many questions, but I think we're supposed to start the award ceremony. I'm looking at the executive office and the minister. So, one more question, okay, take one more question and then. I just want to make sure, since I'm generally the timekeeper, that I'm not keeping this away.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. I think you have saved me a lot with it. I attended a training from the Climate Reality Project. The project is funded by Alcor. And at that training, they attempted to give an estimate of the conference greenhouse gas emissions itself. What if the greenhouse gas emissions can be generated? And they look carefully at carbon credits and get some carbon credits to offset the conference. So I was just thinking that maybe that's a direction that we could look at.
So are you offering to chair that? Because you know way more than I do, so happy to have that. You know, one of the things that I've been walking around is that I know, because I've seen the budgets, I know how much the society spends on food, and I know how much we eat and don't eat, and I'm sure just the food waste alone is enormous. But part of this is the food industry, right? I mean, we're the fattest nation in the world for a reason, where we have a food industry that tells us to eat and eat and eat, and not just eat really healthy food, but just eat. So we supersize everything, and that's part of the food industry that's telling us. And then we've got a health industry, and you know, that my colleague says is not really healthcare at all, it's medical treatment, and so, waiting for your book to come out, Barbara. And then we have a health industry that's growing, right, a medical industry that's growing as well, and all of that's, you know, there's a profit to be made somewhere there, insurance companies, etc. So this is where the intersections and the connections of all these institutions would be really fascinating to study. And I don't have those answers. Because, and I'm just going to say this sort of, I don't mean to be sarcastic here. I mean, my job really was to illuminate climate change as a social problem. I'm asking your job to go out and do all the work that you do and do that work. I don't have all those answers. So.